American companies may soon face new pressure to guard themselves against cyber attacks. The Senate will soon consider cybersecurity legislation. Lawmakers are asking how to protect our power plants, our water supply, the transportation grid, and other facilities on which our lives depend. It turns out that computer criminals could conceivably hack into those systems and shut them down with disastrous consequences. But the question is whether the owners of those facilities should be required by law to improve their defenses. NPR's Tom Gelton is here with us this morning to talk about this. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so what would it be like if hackers were to shut down one of those systems I just described, like the power grid?
Think Hurricane Katrina. That's a good analogy. No electricity, no communication, no safe water, no transportation. And like a hurricane, you're hit without warning. No time to prepare. It would be a disaster.
And you don't realize how much you need these things until you would lose them. But what's the scenario under which somebody would actually do that?
Well, it could happen during an all-out cyber war, or it could be an act of cyber terrorism. Now, right now, a cyber war is hard to imagine. I talked about this with Bill Lynn, who until recently was the number two at the Pentagon. He's one of the people who has thought the most about these issues. He says a cyber war attack on the U.S. right now is no more likely than a missile attack, because any country that would do something like that knows it would be hit right back. The greater danger, he says, would come from terrorist groups. They're harder to deter.
If terrorist groups were able to acquire these destructive cyber capabilities, I think we should fear greatly that they would use them, because there's nothing to hold them back.
Now, in Lynn's view, there are terrorist groups that would love to carry out an attack like this right now, but he doesn't think they have the capability to do it yet.
So we have an opportunity. We have a window of opportunity to improve our defenses. We don't know exactly how long that window of opportunity is, but I think we should feel a strong need to improve our defenses before that happens.
And that's the situation. And Steve, defenses have to be improved because the companies that operate power plants and water systems right now are not that well prepared to cope with a cyber attack.
Why would they not be more than a decade after 9/11?
Well, Steve, remember that computer hackers generally work through the internet. Not always, but generally. As long as the equipment operating these facilities was isolated from the internet, they were somewhat protected from hackers. But as these systems have been modernized, inevitably there are points where they have some online link. And each of those points is a doorway through which cyber attackers can sneak into the system. Sean McGurk used to go out and do what he calls vulnerability assessments of these facilities for the Department of Homeland Security. Over and over, he says, the operators told him their plants were not connected to the internet.
And as I testified before Congress, in no case had that ever been true. In hundreds of vulnerability assessments, we've always found connections between the equipment on the manufacturing floor and the outside world.
Former Homeland Security expert there who spoke with NPR's Tom Gelton, who is in our studios. And Tom, what he's telling you there is that even the companies themselves do not realize how vulnerable they are.
Right. And Steve, remember, about 90% of these institutions are privately owned. They're outside the government's direct control. And if the owners don't think they're vulnerable to cyber attack, they're less likely to spend the money to bolster their cyber defenses. That's why some folks say legislation is needed, basically to require them to do certain things.
To require them to spend the money because they don't think in their assessment that the risk is worth the cost.
Let me give you an example. This is the CEO of a power company in Georgia who was interviewed about cybersecurity concerns. Let me read you what he said. These are his words. There's been an awful lot written about cybersecurity and the threat of it. There are a lot of people who want to spend a huge amount of money on something we have not necessarily identified. Show me an event, he says, where we've lost systems due to cyber terrorism. I'm not aware of one. Now, that's just one CEO, but he illustrates this reluctance to adopt expensive new cybersecurity measures, and it's because of attitudes like that that there's a move in Congress now to boost awareness of cybersecurity problems.
More than one piece of legislation, if I'm not mistaken. So what are the key differences, the key approaches, the different approaches to this?
Mostly it comes down to whether you require companies to improve their cybersecurity or just encourage them. The most prominent bill is sponsored by Senators Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, Susan Collins of Maine, and others. It would require companies to notify the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, of any and all intrusions into their networks. As of now, they don't have to tell anyone when they've been attacked. It would also establish baseline cybersecurity standards that all companies in a particular sector would be required to meet. But it has run into some strong opposition.
Unelected bureaucrats at the DHS could promulgate prescriptive regulations on American businesses.
This is Senator John McCain of Arizona.
The regulations that would be created under this new authority would stymie job creation, blur the definition of private property rights, and divert resources from actual cybersecurity to compliance with government mandates.
Senator McCain is reading from a statement there. He has a separate cybersecurity bill that promotes voluntary measures over requirements. You also have people like Congressman James Langevin of Rhode Island, who has sponsored legislation on the House side similar to the Lieberman-Collins bill. Here's his take on why some companies oppose these requirements to improve their cybersecurity.
I would assess that the owners and operators of critical infrastructure have employed a minimum level of security, because employing more robust cybersecurity would cost money and affect the bottom line. So they're putting profits ahead of public safety, in my opinion.
It's important to recognize, however, that this debate is not playing out on partisan lines. Among the strongest advocates of tough cybersecurity regulations are some national security types who served in the last Bush administration: Michael Chertoff, the former Secretary of Homeland Security, and Michael McConnell, the Director of National Intelligence under President Bush. McConnell says he's normally a fierce free market advocate, but he says more government regulation is sometimes needed. In this case, the need to improve our cyber defenses warrants it.
This threat is so intrusive, it's so serious, it could literally suck the life's blood out of this country. If we don't address it, it's going to be a severe impact. And so I think we have no choice but to address it. And some of that process will be regulatory.
Regulatory. So McConnell's on the side favoring a mandatory approach.
Of course, all this is being considered by the Senate, where things do not necessarily move quickly. What kind of legislation could realistically emerge in the coming weeks?
Well, there's going to be some compromise between Republican and Democratic proposals. Even the advocates of strict oversight of critical infrastructure recognize there's only so much government can do in this area. The Department of Homeland Security can demand that companies improve their cybersecurity, but it's the companies themselves that know best what measures can be taken and how to take them. They're the ones with the expertise. So no matter which cybersecurity bill gets passed, our critical infrastructure won't be protected against cyber attack unless the government and private industry find a way to work together.
Tom, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
NPR's Tom Gelton covers national security issues.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time for All Tech Considered. We're going to take a drive now in search of what many people are looking for these days: the cheapest gas. And yes, there's an app for that. Several companies have developed smartphone applications to help you search for the lowest price near you. NPR's Jeff Brady tried out a couple of them.
I'm in my car in Philadelphia with only a quarter of a tank of gas left. I've pulled off the road and have my phone out. Here's the Gas Buddy application. I push the big green button that says Find Gas Near Me, and it looks like the cheapest station is only 0.2 miles away. The price, $3.71 a gallon. I'm at the gas station now, and some good news. The price has actually gone down 2 cents since it was last updated on Gas Buddy. But there's also a problem. That's the cash price. I need to use a credit card, and that's 8 cents a gallon more, so $3.77 a gallon. That isn't quite the bargain I thought it was. It turns out that's an issue Jason Taves, co-founder of GasBuddy.com, is working on.
One of the things that we're going to add to the application and to the website is the ability to enter cash and credit prices. Right now, it's just the cheapest price.
Taves says his company receives about 500,000 gas price reports every day.
It's all based on local people in every city across the country logging into the app or to the website and sending in the gas prices.
It's a surprisingly accurate method. While the first station I visited had a lower price, four others I drove by were right on. The key is keeping the prices up to date. Once a report is more than a day or two old, it's kicked out of the system. Tave says his app even saved him a few bucks recently in Chicago.
And I was at one station where the price was $4.68 a gallon, and not even 2 miles away, it was at $4.14 That's a 54 cent per gallon savings. I'm not saying that you can always save that much, but it's pretty easy to save 10 or 15 cents per gallon.
TAVE's application is free. There are small advertisements on the screen. If you don't like that, there's the Fuel Finder app for just under $3. It was created by the same company that makes NPR's smartphone applications. Calvin Carter is the founder of Bottle Rocket Apps. His includes a few more features, like an estimate of how long it will take to drive to the cheapest gas station.
And also, we have the ability to tell you exactly how many dollars per tank you're going to save so you can make a really good, quick decision. Is it worth driving an extra mile to save what might be $3 or $4 a tank?
And there's a feature that has nothing to do with prices called On Fumes.
This allows you to see a lot more stations and allows you to find the closest station in the case, obviously, that you're running out of gas. You just want to get to a gas station fast.
So I found the gas station with the cheapest credit card price around, $3.73 a gallon. That's 4 cents less than the last place I was at. I pumped 11 gallons for a total savings of 44 cents. Not sure that was worth driving 2 miles for. But 44 cents is 44 cents. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Philadelphia.
Well, distraction aside, for many, the benefit of being connected is, of course, being connected to family, friends, colleagues. But for some people, that's not necessarily a good thing. NPR's Patty Naiman reports on what Facebook can mean for people with low self-esteem.
People with low self-esteem tend to see the glass half empty, and they often share their negative feelings with their friends in person. So researchers wondered if they shared their low self-esteem online as well. Amanda Forrest is a psychology researcher at the University of Waterloo in Canada.
People with low self-esteem tend to be very cautious and self-protective, so it's very important to them to gain others' acceptance and approval, and they really want to avoid being rejected. So given that, we thought perhaps people with low self-esteem might censor what they're saying to present a kind of positive and likable self-image on Facebook.
So Forrest collected status updates from 177 student volunteers. The updates were rated on how positive or negative they were. It turned out people with low self-esteem posted lots of unhappy updates.
Things like, what a terrible day. They might have said that they were frustrated because the classes they had wanted to take were all reserved, or upset because the TV show they were hoping to watch had been a rerun. Some people were just quite extreme and said they were filled with rage and sorrow or felt hollow inside.
On the other hand, people with high self-esteem posted lots of positive updates, like being happy, excited, or thankful for something. When researchers asked people rating the updates if they wanted to get to know those who wrote the negative posts, the answer was a resounding no. Researchers even looked at actual Facebook friends.
Because you might think that, a real friend would care if you're expressing negativity and might be a little bit more sensitive and less likely to say, ugh, you know, I don't want to hear this, than a complete stranger would.
But no, the actual friends didn't like the negative posts much either. The posts actually backfired, not winning new friends or generating good feelings. Psychologists say even for people with high self-esteem, aspects of Facebook can be difficult. For example, when everybody else gets lots of likes or thumbs up on a post and you don't. John Schultz is a 24-year-old law student who recently deleted his Facebook account. Too public and too much of a distraction, he says.
If you'd posted something or put up something and nobody liked it or nobody recommended it, it's either you feel that your idea was worthless and nobody really valued it, or you've made people mad.
And when friends plaster photos across Facebook walls, that can be equally upsetting, says Schultz, if you're not in the photos.
So if friends went someplace or to a concert or to a movie and you weren't invited or you were working, you find out much more quickly that you weren't a part of that group, and it starts to feel like you were either specifically excluded or at minimum forgotten about.
Made even worse, he says, because everybody can see that you weren't part of the group.
And especially in high school, when where you were, who you were with, was probably more important than anything else at that time.
Dr. Mike Brody is a psychiatrist at the University of Maryland and in private practice.
This is a time in life where kids, in terms of development, are moving away from their family. Friends become much more important. It's very, very important to be chosen, not just in terms of romantic interests, but also in terms of friendships.
Bottom line for everyone, says Brody, no matter how much self-esteem you have, be selective, especially since posts live in cyberspace forever. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
And another tech story today about an industry that is changing rapidly. Hotels still need bartenders and bellhops, but these days they're in the market for digital bloodhounds, people who understand how to use technologies to lure potential customers. NPR's Margot Adler introduces us to one hotel's tech expert.
Greg Bodenloss is 24 years old, just a couple of years out of Cornell University's School of Hotel Administration.
So my official title is a digital marketing strategist, or digital marketing specialist specifically for this hotel.
That's the Mark Hotel in New York City, a luxury property. But this profession is so fluid and new, Bodenloss had to write up his own job description. And at other hotels, he says the equivalent position might be called e-commerce manager, revenue manager, social media coordinator. He reeled off five other possible titles. He knew if he wanted a marketing job in hospitality right out of school,
it had to be digital, it had to be analytical. I mean, quite honestly, the digital marketing space in hotels, it is completely wide open. We're just figuring out how to use the tools that Google and Facebook throw at us.
And here's one of his professors, Bill Carroll, who teaches at Cornell.
I tear up my syllabus every year.
Now, you might make a reservation by calling a hotel or going online to compare prices. You might use a mobile app on your phone or use Facebook. This means the role of a hotel marketing manager has changed from a time when they pretty much guessed whether their ad in a magazine or newspaper worked to a point where you can begin to track behavior by analyzing click streams. Bill Carroll says in the future we will know.
Did you contact me through the call center, through my brand website, through a salesperson, and subsequently, did you execute a booking? And once I've got that clickstream behavior,
he can figure out the steps by which a booking was made.
We're not there yet, but I believe we will be in 5 years.
Since the hospitality industry grows somewhat like the U.S. economy, maybe 2% a year, the main task of these companies is called shifting share, taking business away from somebody else. Greg Bodenloss at The Mark wants to know, how many bookings are we getting from online travel agencies?
How many bookings are we getting from a call center? How many bookings from mobile? How many bookings from social, and how many bookings from really what we want, again, is our direct website. And how can we shift that?
One thing these e-commerce managers do is to buy keywords on the paid part of Google and other sites so that their website will come up at or near the top of a search. And there are companies to help you figure out the right words to buy.
We all want top page placement on Google because we know that 97% of consumers, they'll just look at the top 10 results and that's all they look.
Now take a company like Oyster.
So this here is software engineering and design, and people are actually writing the code that makes the site work.
Launched in 2009, Oyster sends investigators to hotels. They write serious reviews. The site lists some 4,000 properties in 188 cities. So consumers can figure out exactly what they want. 15 years ago, maybe you got a brochure, but often you ended up at a hotel without knowing what it looked like. Oyster CEO Ellie Seidman says it was another leap in technology over the past few years that made Oyster possible. Digital photos in low light.
We have to, A, be able to take those in the first place, you know, in the available light. And then we have to get those photos back to New York, get them processed.
Oyster gets paid because, again, you can track the clicks and find out whether someone who ended up, let's say, at a particular Marriott first came to Oyster. The people getting the tech jobs in the hotel industry are knowledge workers. Bill Carroll.
Competent technically, competent digitally. You also have to be a collaborative manager. You have to get other folks to go along with you.
The people who get those jobs, he says, geeks who speak. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, automatically backing up computer files for individuals and small businesses worldwide. Learn more at carbonite.com.
This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green. Good morning to you. Today, in your health, what your Facebook posts say about your self-esteem. But first, smartphones and tablets in the hospital. Like most of us, doctors love to try the latest and greatest new gadgets, and many have eagerly embraced digital devices as useful tools for their trade. But critics worry that their widespread use could end up distracting doctors from patient care. Jenny Gold of our partner Kaiser Health News recently went to Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, where mobile devices are just about everywhere.
Dr. Henry Feldman is a mobile technology evangelist. He struts boldly around Beth Israel, armed with an iPhone and iPad. Some people even refer to him as the eye doctor. That's the letter I, not a vision specialist. Feldman says mobile technology has made him a better physician.
The advantage of the iPad is it lets me do everything I could do if I was sitting at my desktop at the patient's bedside, and actually some things that I couldn't easily do at the office setting. But I find in general it speeds me up a lot.
He gives free lectures for doctors at the Apple Store in Boston, where he touts the iPad as a revolution in patient care. It allows him to show patients anatomy drawings, surgical videos, and medical records right at their bedside. Recently, Feldman used his iPad with patient John Garrett and his wife Sherry shortly after surgery, showing them actual photos taken during the procedure.
So if we look, this is them going in, and then they're cutting it right here.
I love the pictures.
Yeah, I do too.
It's fantastic. Because I wasn't exactly there.
Right. You were asleep.
Yes, right. That's right. Yeah. Those are great.
Beth Israel is almost entirely electronic, but Chief Operating Officer John Halomka says paper will always have its place.
The paperless hospital is as likely as the paperless bathroom. It is possible, but not necessarily easily achievable. So we don't have complete absence of paper. I just would say we have eliminated as much paper as possible.
Halomka is also co-chair of the federal government's Committee on Health Information Technology. But recently, he's been issuing a warning. All of this mobile technology has a downside: distracted doctors.
I think all of us who use mobile devices have what I will call continuous partial attention. And that is, we're engaged in our work, but at the same time, we're checking that email or we're glancing at that instant message.
Most of the 1,000 iPads and 1,600 iPhones at Beth Israel are owned by the doctors themselves. That makes it hard for the hospital to dictate which apps they can have on their devices. In a recent survey, 55% of medical technicians nationwide said they used their cell phones during procedures, and nearly half admitted texting. Dr. Halomka says he's experienced the problem of distraction himself as a specialist on cases where patients ingest poisonous mushrooms.
So what will happen is I will typically get a telemedicine email of a photo of a mushroom and then a question. What should we do? Well, the problem is I'm looking at that on a mobile device. So at the same time, I'm trying to make a treatment decision. I'm getting a phone call, I'm getting a text, I'm getting some information pushed to me from some application.
In December, Halomka wrote up a case study of an incident at a different hospital. A team of doctors there was making rounds and decided to stop giving one patient a blood thinner he was on. But as one of the residents was entering the new order into her smartphone, she got a text about a party. She was so busy RSVPing that she never completed the drug order. It wasn't a small mistake. The patient almost died.
So, gee, if you forgot to pick up something at the grocery store, it's an inconvenience. If you forgot to stop a blood thinner, it can result in significant harm.
Halomka is trying to implement new policies at Beth Israel to prevent such a problem from happening there. The hospital now has written guidance for doctors on how to avoid distraction on their mobile devices, and they're experimenting with ways to block social networking apps in the facility. But Henry Feldman, the eye doctor, says of all the distractions he faces at the hospital, mobile technology is the least concerning.
Unlike my mobile technology, which I can shut off and not pay attention to, I can't not pay attention to the nurse who's directly in front of me. Shutting off the nurses is a quick career-ending move around here.
He says doctors have always had to deal with the mayhem of a hospital. Compared to the quiet buzz of a mobile device, he insists that human noise is much more distracting. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Gold.
Here in Washington, later today, the House of Representatives is expected to pass the so-called Jobs Act. Among other provisions, the bill will now allow startups to raise money from a potential pool of thousands of small investors online and through social networks. From Silicon Valley, NPR's Steve Henn reports on the potential impact of this change.
Rod Turner has worked for lots of startups. Some have made it big, but he thinks
venture capital as we know it is kind of history, really. It's an outdated model.
Turner says the way most tech companies get funding these days is out of whack. The lion's share of all startup investments flows to little companies in Silicon Valley, the Bay Area, and a handful of other technology hotspots.
$3,000 of venture capital is invested per year per man, woman, and child.
In the greater Silicon Valley area. In comparison, venture capitalists invest just
$16 per man, woman, and child per year in Michigan.
Turner hopes the jobs bill will change that. It expands how startups can raise money, allows them to solicit investors online, and for the first time, it clears the way for average folks to invest, instead of just the rich. Turner has plans to launch his own crowdfunding platform within 2 months. But according to some critics, like Senator Jeff Merkley, a Democrat from Oregon, the original version of this bill could have been a disaster.
Basically, a scheme for pump and dump operators seeking to defraud American citizens.
Merkley and a bipartisan group of senators imposed some new restrictions last week, and their amended version is poised to pass the House today. President Obama is expected to sign it later this week. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.